Okay, well, thank you very much for the introduction, and this is I'm sure it's a topic that many of us are really concerned about, the teaching of reading in America. And I'm often asked how I got involved in this education business, because I'm not a certified teacher, I'm not a professional educator, I'm not a professor of education. I'm a writer, basically, and I write on these subjects because I became very concerned some years ago when I was an editor at Gross & Dunlap in New York City in the early 1960s, and a friend of mine by the name of Watson Washburn had created a new organization called the Reading Reform Foundation, and he came to my office and asked if I would become a member of his National Advisory Council for his new organization. So I asked him, well, what is the Reading Reform Foundation going to do? What is its aim? And he said, well, our goal is to get phonics back in the schools. And I looked at him, I was sort of surprised. What do you mean, get phonics back in the schools? Since when was it taken out? And so then he began to tell me how in the early 1930s, the professors of education throughout the alphabetic phonics method, which is a proper way to teach children to read an alphabetic writing system, and they put in this new look-say or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese, an ideographic writing system. And I said, that's absolutely preposterous. How can anyone learn to read that way? And he said, well, that's what they're doing. And he suggested that I read Dr. Rudolf Flesch's book, Why Johnny Can't Read, which was published in 1955. Do you know how long ago that? Most of you weren't born yet. And we already knew we had a reading problem in 1955. So I read Dr. Flesch's book, and of course, he confirmed what my friend had told me. And he made a very interesting statement. Dr. Flesch said that when you impose an ideographic writing system on an ideographic teaching technique on an alphabetic writing system, yes. When you impose an ideographic teaching method on an alphabetic writing system, you get reading disability. That was pretty clear. And of course, Flesch had come to that conclusion after having studied the problem. He was rather shocked. He had been born in Austria and had been taught to read by the phonics method. And of course, he was getting a mother had brought a little child to him who couldn't read. And he found out that the reason why the child couldn't read was because he hadn't been taught in the proper way in the schools. And so that's how I first found out about this, and I joined the Reading Reform Foundation. Well, then, in 1970, I decided that I wanted to write full-time. And so I went to my friend, Neil McCaffrey, who is the owner of the Conservative Book Club, and I asked him, we discussed various book ideas, and he said, well, could you do a book on how to start your own private school? And I said, well, sure, I could look into the matter, do a little research. He said, there are a lot of parents these days who are dissatisfied with the public schools, and they're creating these alternative schools. So how about doing a book on that subject? So I did a little research and decided that I could do the book. I traveled all over the country visiting private schools of every possible kind, particularly those started by parents. But then I also wanted to find out what was going on in the public schools, to find out why parents were so dissatisfied. And so I decided to get into the public schools. Now, the easiest way to get into a public school, of course, is to become a substitute. The only qualification you need is to be warm. And so I became a I started teaching in the high schools and junior high schools of Quincy, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston where I lived at the time. And I was shocked. I hadn't been in a public school since the 1940s. That 30 years ago, and so I was, really rudely shocked by what I saw, the Mickey Mouse t-shirts, the The whole atmosphere was so slovenly, academically, every which way, with the litter on the floor. I mean, the school I was going to when I was a kid, if there was litter on the floor, my heavens, you picked it up. I mean, the idea of litter on the floor of a school, that's unheard of when I was going to school. Anyway, I was shocked. But what even shocked me more was the poor reading ability of the students. And I said to myself, I thought that Rudolf Flesch had solved the problem. He told the educators what was wrong, that they had discarded phonics in place of look-say, and that was causing problems. That's why Johnny couldn't read. And I found out that Johnny still couldn't read. As a matter of fact, these kids were stumbling and fumbling and reading as if they just, you know, that they're a bunch of foreigners. And I knew what it was like because I came from an immigrant family. My mother couldn't read. She was illiterate, so I knew what illiteracy was like. And I was shocked. I said, these are Americans attending an American school. These kids are born here, and they're having trouble learning to read. Something terrible is going on. So I decided to do a book on the reading problem to bring it up to date, because Flesch's book had been written in 55, and here it was already the 70s. And so I began to do research on this. And first I wanted to find out who in his right mind would have ever conceived of a method of teaching children to read English as if it were Chinese. That just didn't make sense to me. I thought either this was someone who was insane or what? It just made no sense at all. And so I did the historical research, and I found out that the man who first conceived of that idea was not insane at all. He was the Reverend Thomas H. Gallaudet, the teacher of the deaf and dumb in the 1820s and 30s. I mean, he had to teach the deaf to read by a non-phonetic method. And so he wrote the first sight primer because he taught the read by juxtaposing a word and a picture. And the deaf would learn to read in a rather cursory manner in that way. Well, Dr. Gallaudet thought that perhaps normal children could be taught to read that way, and it would, you know, if his method could be adapted for their use. And so he brought out a little primer called the Mother's Primer, in that primer, he taught sight words. The child was taught to read, something like 50 or so words by sight as whole configurations before he even started teaching the child the alphabet. And the Boston primary schools at the time, being very progressive, decided to adopt Gallaudet's primer for use in the schools of Boston in 1837. Well, by 1844, the situation became so disastrous as far as the reading ability of the kids that the schoolmasters, that is, those in the grammar schools, the higher-ups, said, this method is turning our kids into a bunch of illiterates. We've got to get rid of it. And they wrote a scathing critique of this new sight method. And when I wrote my book on the subject, The New Illiterates, I reprinted that critique written in 1844, which told exactly why that method doesn't work. So we've known since 1844 that the look-say-sight method doesn't work. Well, in those days, they didn't have a National Education Association, so the schools were able to very simply go back to the phonetic method, which they did, and the kids were taught to read. But around the turn of the century, there arose a new group of educators, the progressives. Now, who were these people? The progressives were members of the Protestant academic elite who no longer believed in the religion of their fathers. They no longer believed in the Bible. They now put their faith in science, evolution, and psychology. Science explained the material world. Evolution explained the origin of man. You know, we all arose out of the primordial ooze. And, psychology now gave them the scientific means to study human nature. the human mind and human behavior, and also it gave them a scientific means of controlling human behavior. So they said, we've got it all. We don't need God. We've got it all. Now, these men were also socialists. Now, why were they socialists? Well, you see, when you discard the Bible, when you decide that the Bible is just mythology, you have to come up with your own theory of evil. The Bible tells us where evil comes from. It doesn't come from the ozone, you know. Where does evil come from? The Bible tells it comes from the human heart, because we are fallen. We are sinners. Our ancestors, our parents fell in the Garden of Eden. They disobeyed God. And we have inherited that basic sinful nature. The Catholics call it original sin. The Calvinists call it innate depravity. I prefer that particular term. Innate depravity. What does that mean? That we're all depraved, doing everything depraved every day? No, it means we have the capacity for depravity. And that when you don't believe in God, and when you live according to your own passions and desires to want, what happens? You could be as depraved as possible. And the 20th century has certainly given us more than enough examples. Besides Jeffrey Dahmer, we've had the whole Nazi movement, you see. So we know that man does have that sinful nature, which can be exercised. But the Bible also tells us how we can avoid falling into that trap. If we live in accordance with biblical principles, we can lead a happy, productive, long life. But God has set us the parameters. In other words, the Bible is our user's manual. Tells us how to live. I mean, you know, when you buy an automobile, they give you a user's manual and they tell you when to do all of the, you know, how many times to change the oil. Well, God gave us a user's manual. He said, if you live in accordance with my principles, you can live a happy, healthy, productive, long life. If you don't, if you live according to your own passions, your own lusts, you'll wind up where so many people are winding up today. It's as simple as that. Well, anyway, these men had to deal with the problem of evil. And so what causes evil? They said, well, it's caused, we know, by ignorance, poverty, and social injustice. And what causes social injustice? It's this horrible capitalist system of ours. Private property, you know, selfishness, individualism. We got to get rid of that and replace it with collectivism and atheism or humanism. And so they embarked on this messianic mission to change America from an individualistic, religious, capitalist society to a collectivist, atheist, humanist society. Now, how are they going to do this? You see, these men were imbued with a messianic mission. Why? Because they had to prove that they were right and the Bible was wrong. And the only way they could do that was to bring about socialism. Now, this was in the late 1800s, 1890s, before the Russian Revolution, before Nazism, before fascism. You see, so, and they truly believed that socialism would produce this utopia. In fact, the model they used was not Karl Marx, but a book written by an American by the name of Edward Bellamy. The book is entitled Looking Backward, and it was published in 1888. And what Mr. Bellamy did in that book is he projected the fantasy of a socialist America in the year 2000. So if you want to read about what is socialism, pick up that book in the library. There it is. It'll tell you exactly what their vision was. Total egalitarianism. Total egalitarianism, which is what our schools are now into. Total egalitarianism with cooperative learning. Have you heard of cooperative learning? In cooperative learning, the kids learn in a group, and the smart kids and the slow kids all get the same grade. You got a group grade. You may have a very gifted child who will get 90 in the test, and your child's score will go down to the level of the group. The group average. That's egalitarianism. Everybody's equal. Anyway, that's going on in today's schools. Well, getting back to the reading problem, it was John Dewey who analyzed the capitalist religious system, and he came to the conclusion that high literacy was the culprit. He said, high literacy is what sustains this system that we want to get rid of. He said that high literacy produces people with this independent intelligence who can stand on their own 2 feet and think for themselves. They don't need the collective. In fact, they can curl up in a corner with a book and not care what anyone else is doing. That's very antisocial. And so what he said is we've got to get rid of this high literacy and we have to produce a lower level of literacy that's good for the proletariat, that's good for the workers of this world. That was his belief. And of course, he was the philosophical leader of this movement. And he wrote an essay entitled The Primary Education Fetish, published in 1898, in which he said, quote, there is a false educational god whose idolaters are legion and whose cult influences the entire educational system. This is language study, the study not of foreign language, but of English, not in higher, but in primary education. He says, it does not follow, however, that because this course was once wise, it is so any longer. My proposition is that conditions have undergone such a radical change that the time has come for a thoroughgoing examination of the emphasis put upon linguistic work in elementary education. The plea for the predominance of learning to read in early school life because of the great importance attaching to literature seems to me a perversion. John Dewey. Now, it was John Dewey who set the stage for all of this, and they went along with it. They said, well, we've got to change the way reading is taught in American schools. And they, you know, they did a lot of so-called research, and they decided, we'll revive this look-say method that had been invented by Gallaudet back in the 1830s. We'll revive that, we'll modernize it, and we'll use that method because we already know that it dumbs down the kids. They already knew that it did the job that they wanted. It already dumbed down the kids. So they said, that's the method we'll use. And of course, that was the Dick and Jane method. Dewey said something else that was very interesting. He said, change must come gradually. To force it unduly would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction. Now, why would parents violently react to something that was good? No. So, in other words, this change had to take place so gradually that parents would not even know that it was taking place. Now, the educators started working on changing the curriculum. The progressives started working on changing every facet of the primary school, of the entire curriculum, because they wanted to produce little socialists. And of course, the primary curriculum had to change, and they changed the form of teaching reading. And the look-say books, the Dick and Jane and the Macmillan readers, were ready by 1930. It took them that long to get a set of books that would be used by all the schools in America. Prior to that, some schools used the look-say method. In fact, it was tried out in some of the progressive private schools. For example, there was the Lincoln School, which was attached to Teachers College at Columbia University. The Lincoln School was an experimental school. John D. Rockefeller donated $3 million to the Lincoln School, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and he sent 4 of his sons there, 3 of whom emerged functionally illiterate. Did you know that Nelson Rockefeller couldn't read? He was dyslexic. And what he would do, if he had to read a speech, he would put it aside and speak extemporaneously. And he would joke about the fact that he had gone to a progressive school and never learned to read. His brother, Lawrence, bemoaned the fact that reading was so difficult for him. And of course, their brother, Winthrop, did so poorly that he had to drop out of Yale University. Of course, that didn't stop him from becoming governor of Arkansas. Anyway, what did it prove? It proved that the richest man, the sons of the richest man in the world, could be turned into functional illiterates by the system. Now, did Don D. Rockefeller Jr. put his sons in the school to become functionally illiterate? No. Like so many of these rich people, he was, you know, thought he was doing a great thing. Experiments are wonderful, progressives are wonderful, but that was the result. And now these books were put in the schools, and by 1955, we already had a reading disaster. That's why Rudolf Flesch could write a book, you know, Why Johnny Can't Read. Well, I wrote my book, The New Illiterates, came out in the 1970s after I discovered that nothing had changed. The educators had no intention of going back to incentive phonics just because of Rudolf Flesch, you see. And so I did my book to show that why that happened. Because what happened was the educators formed the teachers of reading, the professors of reading, not so much the teachers. Because even in those days, there were teachers who knew that Dick and Jane didn't work and you had to teach some phonics. So these older teachers would teach phonics using the Dick and Jane books because those were the only books that were now available. And we called that sort of phonics bootleg phonics. You know, these teachers had to close the door and teach phonics on the side. So a lot of kids did learn to read even though they had the Dick and Jane books. But in any case, by the 1970s, the situation was just as bad. The professors of reading had circled the wagons and created the International Reading Association, which became the most important professional organization for the teachers of reading, you see. Now, we move on. The same people who created the Look-Say books and then also created the... what happened was when parents began to understand what Look-Say was all about, the professors then decided to change the terminology. So they went from Look-Say to psycholinguistics. They called it psycholinguistics. Then when parents caught on to that, they now call it whole language. Whole language is the new form of the sight method. In other words, they minimize the teaching of phonics. They have to teach some phonics, though, to prevent the kids from, you know, guessing too badly. You know, the difference between phonics... phonics is very... It's very easy to teach a child to read phonetically. All you do is teach a child the letters of the alphabet, the sounds that the letters stand for, and before you know it, they can sound out words and they can sound out sentences and little stories, etc. Very easy, inexpensive too, very cheap to do. But to teach children to read by this Look-Say method, what they do is they introduce kids to words as holistic configurations. For example, take the word horse. The teacher will draw a little frame around it and say, see the picture of the horse? Now, as you and I know that H-O-R-S-E doesn't look like a horse. So the child has got to use some device where he can see a horse. I mean, you could do it if you had to, I suppose. Maybe the H will look like a head, you know, sticking up. But that's the way they do it. And so what happens was that first they would give that. They called that the configuration clue. Then they would provide picture clues. They'd have so many pictures of horses on the page that the child would just come to the conclusion, that word must say horse. You know. And, of course, you can't always have horses whenever you use the word horse because you've got other things to illustrate. So then they would provide context clues. They'd give the child a sentence such as, the man put the saddle on the, and the child would think, could be a donkey, could be a mule, but it's probably a horse. But then they also encourage word substitutions. If the child sees the word horse and says pony, they'll say that's correct because the child is seeing the picture. You see. Now they also teach phonetic clues. Why do they teach phonetic clues? Because they realize that the children have to have some phonetic knowledge. Some phonetic knowledge. But where does that knowledge go? It's parked up in the brain. And it's sometimes it's used, sometimes it's not used. It's not automatic. So when a whole language teacher tells you that they teach phonics, what they do is they give the child phonetic information. There's a big difference between teaching intensive systematic phonics, in which the child learns to read automatically, phonetically, because that child has developed a phonetic reflex. But when the child has developed a holistic reflex, which is what they try to do in whole language, then the child looks at each word automatically as being a picture, a whole configuration, and that creates a block against seeing the words in their phonetic structure, particularly if you don't know anything about the phonetic structure. So that's what happens. But also there's also a considerable difference in the philosophy of reading between the phonetics and whole language. And I'll give you, what I will do is read to you a simple definition of the phonetic. The phonetic definition of reading is given by Noah Webster. You know, who's a better authority than that? And this is what he says in his dictionary. He said, to read, to utter or pronounce written or printed words, letters or characters in the proper order. Very simple. To repeat the names or utter the sounds customarily annexed to words, letters or characters. Very simple, easy to understand, you see. To utter or pronounce written or printed words, letters or characters in the proper order. That's it. Well, let me give you now the whole language definition of reading. You see, they say that they have a philosophy, that whole language is not a method, it's a philosophy of reading. You see. And this is their definition. And I got this out from a book entitled Whole Language, What's the Difference? Published in 1991, written by three whole language professors. And this is how they define whole language. Quote, from a whole language perspective, reading is a process of generating hypotheses in a meaning-making transaction in a socio-historical context.
Please turn the tape over for continuation of the program.
They go on. Oh, they're not finished yet. As a transactional process, reading is not a matter of getting the meaning from the text as if that meaning were in the text waiting to be decoded by the reader. Rather, reading is a matter of readers using the cues print provide and the knowledge they bring with them to construct a unique interpretation. Moreover, that interpretation is situated. Readers' creations, not retrievals of meaning, with the text vary depending on their purposes for reading and the expectations of others in the reading event. This view of reading implies that there is no single correct meaning for a given text, only plausible meanings. Unquote. That's a totally subjective way of looking at reading. You decide what it says. You interpret it. Can you imagine a child of 6 and 7 interpreting the text? First of all, there's not much to interpret in those, little children's stories, except where you've got... But there are another change that was made when they went to whole language. When they went to whole language, they threw out the Dick and Jane type of books. They decided they were going to give the kids real literature. You know, stories about the occult, witchcraft, really interesting stuff. Now, the Dick and Jane books were boring, as you know, but they didn't give kids nightmares, did they? You know, what kind of a nightmare could you get from C Spot Jump, you know? But the new books that the kids were reading in whole language classrooms, they gave them many nightmares, you know. Books about mutilations, human mutilations, cannibalism, witchcraft, the occult. I mean, the teachers knew exactly what kind of books to choose for these kids. So something has changed. Not only are the kids reading subjectively, the phonetic way is objective. You read what the author has to say. not what you'd like him to say. Whereas the whole language method is totally subjective. So you can see there's a vast difference between the two, and that's why we are having this incredible literacy disaster in this country. As a matter of fact, the state of California has admitted, State Department of Education in California has already admitted that they have a literacy disaster on their hands. The fourth graders in the state of California who were tested scored the lowest in the country. The only states that scored lower were Louisiana and Guam. That's California, where they spend so much money on education. And so the educators are very upset. They put in whole language in 1987 because they already had a reading problem then, and they thought, we'll solve the problem with whole language. So they've had whole language now since 1987. So their kids who are now in the ninth grade who are permanently disabled because of whole language. And what are they going to do about these kids? What do the educators say? The educators say, we goofed. We goofed. That's their response to what's happened in California. We goofed. They've ruined the lives of thousands and thousands of children, and all they can say is, we goofed. You know, what else are they going to do? Well, anyway, you should know that whole language is an integral part of this business called outcome-based education, OBE. Of course, it's no longer called outcome-based education because parents have caught on to it. And the OBE people have decided that they'd better change the name of it. It's now called the Human Resources Development System. Now, how does that system of education, which they are now imposing through all this legislation in Washington, you know, the Goals 2000, school to work, what does all of that mean? What are they doing now? Well, let me compare traditional education to what the new system is. When I was going to school back in the 1940s, 30s, and 40s, I was taught reading, writing, and arithmetic in the proper way. I was actually taught phonics to read. I was taught cursive writing in the first grade. None of this printing nonsense. And I was taught rote arithmetic. And then I was taught history and geography and all the wonderful subjects. Teachers were wonderful. We sat in classrooms where the desks were in rows. They were bolted to the floor. We had desks where if you wanted to put your books, you know, in it, you slid them in underneath. You didn't have this bang, you know, those lids that went bang. We didn't have them. No noise. You didn't talk to your friends or your neighbors. That was a no-no. Teacher sat up front. The focus of attention was on the teacher. She taught everybody the same thing. No individualized lesson plans or education plan. Everybody learned the same thing. No distractions. The only thing on the wall was, you know, maybe a picture of George Washington and an American flag. That was it. And we learned. We learned very well. As a matter of fact, my generation learned so well that we were able to produce the engineers and chemists who have created the foundation for what we have today in this the technological society we have today. Well, after we had that education, and incidentally, we learned some very practical things. I learned touch typing in junior high school. My sister learned steno, in her high school. And of course, then we went out into the world, made our own way. Well, now with the new system, the government will plan your life for you. You see, that's the new human resources development system. Human beings, children, are now considered to be a human resource, to be developed by the government, by the state, to be used by the state for its purposes. In other words, they will now tell you what you're going to be for the rest of your life. They will educate you because now everything's going to be on a computer. You will have an individualized education program that fits what they call your aptitudes. They'll give you an aptitude test very early and decide, well, you should be a plumber, and you should be a doctor, and you should be a member of the elite. So they have now, there are three tracks, or three certificates. There's the certificate of initial mastery, which will be for, you know, everybody who passes a certain grade, I suppose. And then you'll have the certificate for higher education. That's for the elite. That's for the people who are going to run America. You see, we're headed toward a pyramidal society with the elite at the top, the professionals and engineers, etc., right under the ruling elite, and then at the very bottom you have everybody else. And so if you want to become a member of, and who are the people at the elite who are running the country? Well, the Hillarys and Billaries of America. They come out of Yale, you know, get a Rhodes Scholarship, and of course there's the road to the top, you see. So they will select who is to rule over you. Forget about elections and all that sort of thing. That's all phony, because they're going to choose the people you're going to have to vote for. You're not going to have much of a choice. You'll have elite number one or elitist number two to vote for. They'll decide, because we're headed toward this new world order, you see. This is the education system for the new world order. Whole language will dumb down the population so that you'll be easily manipulated and led by the nose. That's why kids are wearing nose rings, so that they can be led by the nose. Have you noticed all the rings? You know, stands to reason. Kids who wear nose rings can be led by the nose. And that's where they're leading us to, this new world order. And God knows how it's going to turn out. And also, they're using mastery learning techniques. Your child will be taught as if he or she were a dog or a cat, an animal. Mastery learning is based on behavioral science, behavioral psychology, and your child will have to learn what they want, that what the elitists want your child to know. No freedom. In other words, and they will restrict what that child has to learn. It'll be just what they want that child to learn. You see, when I went to school, it was like a smorgasbord. And the interesting thing was that they taught you history, but it was up to you how much you learned. I mean, if you wanted to learn a lot, if you were interested, if you studied, you could get an A. But if you got but if you were not as much interested, wanted to do other things, and you got a C, you passed, you got your diploma. But in outcome-based education, they're going to decide that you have got to believe that evolution is fact, and you will not be able to move any further until you will demonstrate that you believe that evolution is fact. You see, you will have to learn and repeat what they want you to learn. You will not have that freedom that we had under a so-called democratic society. Now, also, everybody's going to be on the computer. They have this master monster computer in Washington. Data will be gathered on everybody. Every child who enters the system will be on the computer. And the kind of information that they're going to want every possible bit of information about you, your attitudes, your likes, your family life, all of that's going to be on the computer, because they want to control your life. They want to make sure that you do what they want you to do. They want to make sure that you are politically correct. Because if everybody is on this computer, they'll find out who the dissenters are very quickly. In fact, they also intend to include homeschoolers on the computer. They don't know quite how to do it. First, they're going to try to do it voluntarily by luring. They're going to tell homeschoolers, we'll give you a free computer if you get into our program. You see how they're going to try to do it at first? See, they know the homeschool movement is growing. They're not quite sure how to handle it. But this data gathering system has categories for homeschoolers. So we know that that the child will be on the computer in one way or another. They've been working on this computer now since 1970. 1970s, they've been working on this computer, which means that the educators, the bureaucrats have known where they want to take us for at least 25 years. They've known where they want to take us. You see, they are the protégés of the socialists, of the progressives. These are all progressives who believe that America should be a controlled society. They want they want to finally get us to a socialist system. They're going to dumb us down. The education system now has been totally transformed into one that will lead the kids into global citizenship. You've seen that. They're downgrading patriotism. As far as religion is concerned, you know what they've done to religion in the public schools. This is why I tell parents, you know, you've got to be aware of what's happening. Now, the godfather of public outcome-based education is a professor by the name of Benjamin Bloom. And outcome-based education was really, they started developing it in the 1950s. See, and all of this was being done in the laboratories and the universities where you couldn't see what was going on. It's only then when they began to implement it that parents became aware, hey, these nutty professors are doing something we don't like. I mean, as long as they did it in their laboratories, nobody worried. They said, as long as they leave us alone, we don't care what they're working on. But these behavioral psychologists were very much aware of what had to be done. And Bloom and his group produced a book entitled A Taxonomy of Educational Objectives. And that taxonomy has the outcomes that they want. And this is what he says about the outcomes. He says, this taxonomy is designed to be a classification of the student behaviors which represent the intended outcomes of the educational process. This was written in the 50s. What we are classifying is the intended behavior of students, the way in which individuals are to act, think, or feel as a result of participating in some unit of instruction. Incidentally, my teachers had no desire to know how I felt about anything. Feeling was simply not even, you know, considered. But here they're concerned about how you feel, you see. That's known as affective education. He says, by educational objectives, we mean explicit formulations of the ways in which students are expected to be changed by the educative process. That is, in the ways in which they will change in their thinking, their feelings, and their actions. Well, when I went to school, they weren't interested in changing my feelings or my actions. They simply want to make sure that I got some knowledge, you see. Now, one of the big problems that the behaviorists have is that older kids are more difficult to change than younger kids. So they said, we've got to get hold of these kids as early as possible. And that's why you're seeing this move to get three-year-olds now in the public schools. As a matter of fact, they want to start now monitoring pregnancies and monitoring the upbringing of children from day one, from birth onward, and the child will be on the computer from day one. So Bloom was very concerned, and he wrote this. He said, the evidence points out convincingly to the fact that age is a factor operating against attempts to affect a complete or thoroughgoing reorganization of attitudes and values. You hear that? A complete and thoroughgoing reorganization of attitudes and values. In other words, they want to take a little Christian child and thoroughly reorganize that child's attitudes and values. He says, the evidence collected thus far suggests that a single hour of classroom activity under certain conditions may bring about a major reorganization in cognitive as well as affective behaviors. A single hour of classroom activity. Now, if you learn nothing else from this lecture than the fact that the psychoeducators know how to cause a major reorganization of values in the mind of a child in one single hour of classroom activity, then you've learned why it's so dangerous to put a child in a public school. I know of an 8-year-old second grader in Michigan who hanged himself because of a film he was shown in the classroom. It took only 1 hour in the classroom to change that child's life for good. 1 hour.
You need to break because you've got to have a book signing out here.
What time is it? Oh, is it all over now? Gee. Oh, well, let me just wind it up. I have a book signing, they tell me. In any case, incidentally, the parents went to court. They sued the schools. And the court ruled at the very end that they threw the case out because they said this is a case of educational malpractice. And there is now so much educational malpractice in the United States that the courts cannot handle it. Therefore, forget it. So the educators got away with the death of a child that they of this poor youngster. In any case, I suppose I have to end here. I was going to tell you more about that totalitarian data gathering system. I've got some Xeroxes of pages from that, the handbooks that show you what they're going to be looking into. So if you'd like to get some of them, I'll have them out at the table there. And I'll be speaking again, of course, tomorrow on the teaching of reading. Thank you very much.